Campus FM jipprezenta l-ewwel taħdita minn serje ta' tliet taħdidiet organizzati mid-Dipartiment tal-Malti fl-Università flimkien mal-Kunsill Nazzjonali tal-Isim Malti. Din l-ewwel taħdita se tiddiskuti Pitkin and Creole Languages, Is the Maltese Case Different? Din it-taħdita se ssir mill-Professur Thomas Stoltz, lingwista Ġermaniż b'interess kbir fil-Isim Malti.
Grazzi ħafna għall-istedina ta'kom li hija unur kbir. Mux bis għalija personalment, imma anzi għall-università tiegħi, però għatma kelimt bil-Malti publikament qabel ilhom, għalhekk nibża li ma narafx in Wijib in Jiwib Bilkom il mistosijiet takom bil Malti u forsi ma nifimt kolos bil Malti alix Bremen memx opportunita ta tahdit bil Malti. Alix mandix esperienza ta pratica linguistica Maltia, Germania, ilum ia l'ewel darba li nit kellem aktar min erba kelmit bil Malti. Grazie, grazie, grazie. Alice ni continua blingis. So, Pidgin in Creole, there will be a German accent too in English, so that's no problem with this. Pidgin in Creole languages, why is the Maltese case different? There is a... Let me take you back to the... about 20 years. At that time, I was writing my own PhD thesis on a Creole topic. This was about a Creole language with the politically incorrect name Negro Dutch. Nowadays we would call it differently, but as the language is extinct by now, there's no need to call it differently. But this was the traditional term. At that time, a lot of people had started to invest their energy in research on Creole languages, Pidgin languages, and so on. And a lot of people working in other departments, not in the linguistic department, heard about creolization, and then all of a sudden everything became a creole and everything became an instance of creolization, and the term somehow lost its content. There was a specific content at the start, and in the end everything was creolization. And if any language in the world is a creole, because there is no pure language on the globe. Every language has at least a little bit taken from other languages. If a mixedness of languages is the definition of a Creole, then the term is senseless in a way, that it has no content because there is no difference. It doesn't make any difference to call a language a Creole. This situation also applies to the Maltese case, because at that time people, when they started to think about cases, categories similar to the ones of the prototypical Creoles, they started, oh, it's just this kind of intensive contact phenomena that we find in many languages, for example Maltese. And then people claimed that perhaps, nobody claimed that categorically, but perhaps Maltese is just a kind of covert kind of creolization. It's a creole in a way. Not really the prototype, but it's a creole in a way. That was what people thought for a very long time. There are other languages like Maltese where you can find evidence for heavy influence by other languages, which are candidates of the same category, a kind of Creole, but not really Creoles. So in order to determine what is a Creole, we will have to look at the prototype of Creoles first. But before I come to that, I show that the table of contents, there's the introduction. I've already started with the introduction, okay. Then there is something about Creoles, the typical Creole features, a short comparative passage, Creoles versus Maltese language structures, and then conclusions. This is what was in the back of the minds of those people who thought of Maltese as a Creole language. It is. If you look at Malta, Malta is a meeting place of languages in its history. We know that. There were a lot of occupants of Malta, and the Maltese language itself originated in a situation of language contact. Wherever that took place, be it on Sicily as a kind of Sicilo-Arabic or on Malta itself, it doesn't make any difference in this way, there was contact when Maltese came into being. Language contact is the trigger in the genesis of Maltese, otherwise there would be just Arabic. Now, there must have been something else. And we know that there is a Semitic basis. We can still recognize the Semitic part of Maltese, and then there is a Roman part of Maltese. And it's right to claim that the Semitic part is the original, the retention of the original structure, and that the Romans part is the addition to this basis. I think this is uncontroversial. Hope so. Is Maltese a mixed language then? This is moving up. So, is Maltese a mixed language? Nowadays there is a technical term, mixed language. It's not a mixed language according to the technical term, because it's a very complicated kind of combination. The grammar has to come from language A, and the lexicon has to come from language B. And if that's the case, then we have a mixed language. But that's not true of Maltese, because there is both grammar and lexicon is Romance and Semitic. So there is not this clear-cut division between grammar on one hand, etymologically going back to language A, and lexicon etymologically going back to language B. That's not the case for Maltese, so we could say the modern technical term mixed language cannot be applied to Maltese. But then there is this kind of layman approach to mixed languages, and you can say, yes, it is mixed in the way as any other language is mixed, because there is something of a different language which originated from in a different language there in Maltese. But that's the same for English, that's the same for German, that's the same for Italian, that's the same for Greek, and so on. There is no language where it can be shown that no influence at all had ever happened in the history of that language. A famous German, the founding father of modern linguistics, Wilhelm von Humboldt, has a short passage in his work dating back to 1820, where he says, oh, no language on the globe is really unmixed. There are no pure languages. And then he goes on that we could describe degrees of mixture or mixedness of languages, but he never did this himself. So Maltese is a mixed language in the layman's interpretation of the term, but it's not a mixed language in the linguist's interpretation of the term. So, is Maltese an erstwhile pidgin that developed into a Creole? That's the question. Or is it something else? And in order to determine whether or not Maltese instantiates pidginization, creolization, or language intertwining, that's the term behind the linguist's interpretation of mixed language. You have to intertwine two languages to get mixed language. So that's language intertwining. We first have to come to grips with these notions as they are used in studies devoted to language contact. We can't start from Maltese and then decide whether it is a Creole or not. We have to understand what is a Creole according to the definition and then apply the definition to Maltese. just to tell you this, what happened these 20 years ago again, two instances of inflationary use of the term creolization. One is that Middle English is a creole. The history of English was reinterpreted in terms of creolization. It's no longer a Germanic language because there are so many Romance elements in English. Yeah, there are so many elements in Romance elements in English. And that happened when the Normans occupied England and brought their French with them. And the contact of French and English triggered a development that changed Old English into Middle English, and then Middle English to Early Modern English, and so on. And people believe that this change, because it is a drastic change, is a kind of creolization. If you look at the definitions of a prototypical creole, you won't find this convincing, because it's still a kind of continuity in the history. You can really see this continues what was there in Old English. It's no break in the history of the language. The other case is that even people in literary studies talk about creolization. So if there is a mixture of topics or styles or genres in literature, this is seen, understood as a case of creolization. So the term becomes something else in a different discipline, for example. So let's have a look at the typical instances. What is a creole? The creole prototype. Where is the creole prototype normally spoken? It's normally spoken in a former extra-European, outside Europe, colonial territory of a European country. That's the prototypical case. This is not a definition that excludes all other possibilities, but that's where we started when we defined Creole in the first place. We looked at Jamaica, where this was a British possession outside Europe. That's the typical case. And who spoke the Creoles, or who speaks Creoles, spoken by descendants of slaves deported from their native countries to work in the European possessions. That's the prototypical case. There are other cases as well, but they are on the periphery of the category. The prototype is this one, a European colony somewhere outside Europe, mostly Caribbean Sea and so on, where slaves were imported to work on the plantations. That's really the prototypical case, and you see there are already differences, noticeable differences to the history of Maltese. Maltese is a European territory. It was a colony for some time, okay, that's true, but that was different, and there were no importation of slaves from the typical countries in Africa, for example. So it's different. It hasn't had this background in the history of slavery, for example. And the origin of the speakers, or of the Creole, you can pinpoint the date of birth of a Creole. Not exactly the day, but perhaps the year, say, the century. There was no existence of the Creole prior to the contact between speakers of Indo-European languages, those of the slavers, and speakers of the slaves' native languages. Before that contact, there was no Creole, this particular individual Creole language. It is a new language. And even if the contact influence on a Maltese has always been strong, heavy, there was a continuous history of Maltese, and Maltese was there before the contact with English, for example, or other varieties of Italian started. Now, how does a typical Creole look like? The lexicon stems from an Indo-European language, whereas phonology, morphosyntax, and semantics are largely non-Indo-European. So the lexicon comes from the language of the slavers, and everything else can't be explained in terms of the grammar, phonology, and semantic system of the European language. It is completely different from that, from what we would expect from, say, an English perspective, or a French perspective, or a Portuguese, Spanish, and so on perspective. The lexical material is there, but it's just the shape. The content, the semantic side, may deviate widely from what we know from the semantics of the European donor language. The life cycle, you could say there was no Creole before the year 1450. There was a Maltese before the year 1450, we are confident of that. Now, the social setting. Slaves with a wide range of different native languages work together on plantations without sufficient linguistic input on the part of the European slave masters. Sometimes there weren't any European slave masters around on the plantations, or just one person with hundreds, sometimes thousands, only sometimes thousands of slaves at the same time. So speakers of Indo-European languages are demographically outnumbered by slaves. Then the mortality is high among the slaves because of the conditions on the plantations, the conditions of slavery, and thus a constant afflux from outside is provided by the slavers. They bring in new slaves, and they probably come from different regions, so they don't speak the same language as the first generation of slaves. And this is done in order to keep the plantation economy going, that's clear. Now the slaves live there. For some time, predominantly male slaves were imported, so there was no offspring for some time, and then the slavers realized that the situation was bad for the plantation economy, and then they started to import children and women as well. So after that, slaves with different linguistic background marry and have children who lack a family-based ethnic native language. So the very common situation was that a speaker of language A marries or joins with a speaker of language B. In order to communicate among each other, they had to use a rudimentary version of the language of the slavers without full competence in even in this rudimentary version. And the two speakers in the family, mother and father, could use two different versions of the rudimentary version of the slaver's language. And the children were born into this situation where mother and father didn't share the same language, at least not the same version of the slaver's language. So there was a variation within the family. So are there diachronic steps? Yes. To facilitate communication among the ethnically and linguistically diverse slave population, the slaves have recourse to the lexicon of the slaver's language. That's the jargon stage. That's a technical term for this stage. Given the situation of slavery, we can't expect the slaves to volunteer to learn the language of the slavers. That's a very bad situation because they were the victims of slavery and the victims of the speakers of this prestigious language. So they were perhaps content with learning just bits and pieces of it in order to communicate within the group of slaves. It wasn't meant as a communication means to facilitate communication with the slavers. It was meant for communication within the group of slaves, primarily. There is additional evidence for that because we know that there are different kinds of occupations for slaves. There were house slaves, plantation slaves, and so on. And some of them learned the slaver's language quite well, but nevertheless, they used the Creole in order to preclude their slaver's understanding of the contents of the communication among the slave groups. It's kind of secret language, if you look at that. So the inter-ethnic and intra-group jargon becomes more stable and develops into a pidgin which is in general use among the first slave generations. They still have their native languages from home, from their home countries in Africa. They've come there, it's still the first generation, so they remember their mother tongue. It hasn't gone away, in a way. The pidgin is the family language with different versions according to the native language of the speakers, and thus forms the linguistic input for the second generation of slaves born in the colony. And the input is chaotic in a way because speakers of various languages have a different substratum and interference from their native language. So the pidgin has a kind of variable grammar according to the individual speaker. There's no normative pidgin, for example. So now the children born into these families learn the pidgin as their first language, and thus they become its native speakers. Before that, there were no native speakers of this kind of pidgin, and as soon as there are native speakers, we no longer use the term pidgin. This is for a variety that's not natively used by speakers. Then we use the term Creole. That's the term we use for a language that has acquired native speakers. The first generation of native speakers is basically the second generation, the first colony-born slave children. Now, the former native languages of the first slave generation are gradually lost and may survive as secret languages or hagiolects to be used for religious purposes or for purposes of cults, African cults mostly. So the people don't understand. They are still in use. Some of them are still in use in different places on the world map. People use this for secret cults. Without understanding the words, the meaning of the words, it's just a kind of a kind of church Latin. No? Most of the people didn't understand the Latin used at church, but it had to be Latin because that's the holy language for this cult. What about the time frame? The genesis of a Creole is understood as an abrupt event and not as a drawn-out process. Two generations are said to be enough for the creation of a Creole, and that's not much in the history of a language. Normally, if we talk about language change, for example, it takes some time to yield results, probably centuries. What about the genetic affiliation? To which language family belongs a Creole? If it is a new language. Now, there is some discussion about this. I have my own point of view. There are people who disagree with me, and there are people with whom I disagree. So there is no general agreement, but I think the discussion is quite clearly depicted here. Notwithstanding the fact that the bulk of the Creole lexicon has an uncontroversial Indo-European etymology, Creoles cannot be considered varieties of the Indo-European language, which functions as their major so-called lexifier, the language from which the lexicon stems. Because structurally, and that's not the whole story, the Creoles behave differently from what is expected of varieties of Indo-European languages of Europe, structurally includes semantically. So the semantics of the words used in the Creole, the words look like English, look like French, look like Dutch, look like Spanish, and we can recognize them and say, ah, that must mean, but it doesn't, because it has an African semantics behind it. So the semantics, the content side of the linguistic sign comes from somewhere else, and the signals of the sign, the outer shape in a way, comes from the Indo-European language, the colonizers' language. So this is difficult, and if we claim that these languages, say Jamaican Creole, is a kind of English, that's difficult to defend, because there are so many non-English aspects in it. But there is one problem with determining the genetic affiliation of a language, because that's traditionally based on the criterion of phonologically regular relations in the lexicon. If you have the lexicon and you can determine sound changes, regular sound changes, you already have fulfilled the criterion for proving that two languages are related, genetically related. But that only applies to the lexicon. And it doesn't even apply to the grammatical morphology, for example. To my view, Creoles don't belong to the same phylum or language family as the lexifier. They form a separate, a distinct group. They're not Indo-European languages. But there is a debate about this, and I know that the other opinions are well-founded as well. Now, something about the inventory. If we talk about Creole languages and have reviewed some aspects of the prototype, there are several questions. Where are the prototypes spoken? And most of the showcases of Creolization, those you find everywhere in the literature, are reported for islands in tropical regions on the world map. For example, Caribbean, Jamaica, Haiti, Virgin Islands, Antilles, and so on. Gulf of Guinea, that's Africa. Sao Tome, Principe, Anobon in West Africa. Indian Ocean, Réunion, Mauritius, Seychelles, and so on. In all of these cases, the slave population was imported on a grand scale from various regions of mostly West Africa. This even applies to the Indian Ocean. So people went from West Africa to Mauritius to import slaves from West Africa. There were some slaves from East Africa too, but the bulk came from the western, the very large region, from the Senegal down to Angola, where the people, the slaves were recruited from. Which are the major Indo-European lexifiers? These are the most powerful colonial nations of the early modern age. Portugal, Portuguese is there very strong. French, of course, because France was a great colonizer. English, of course, Spanish and Dutch. You hardly find anything else. There is hardly evidence for Italian. There is some little evidence for isolated cases. Then there is some German, one instance of a kind of German-based pidgin, but that's all, because Germany and Italy joined the other colonizing nations relatively lately, at the end of the 19th century, and then their colonial empire lasted just for two or three decades. So that wasn't time enough to create a Creole there. Although the conditions were similar to the ones in the prototypical cases. The exact number of Creole languages is still a matter of dispute among specialists. Reliable data are available for about 70 Creoles with an Indo-European lexifier, some of which are already extinct or thought to be extinct. There are other Creoles with a non-Indo-European lexifier, but they are a minority, a clear minority, and we don't really know about most of them. There are some cases of Arabic-based Creoles, pidgins, Kinubi, for example. There are some descriptions of the languages of this kind, and something is reminiscent of the prototypical Creole cases I have reported on, but then there are specialties, deviations from the prototype, and as far as I know, you don't find too many parallels between Creolized varieties of Arabic and Maltese. So that's something else. So now let's have a look at a map. I've taken this map from one of the introductions to Pidgin Creole Languages. It's a bit outdated, but I think the distribution hasn't changed very much. You see there are some points on the map. There is a large number of English-based Creole languages. There are some Portuguese-based. There are many more Portuguese-based, but this is just a selection. Only three Spanish-based ones, three Dutch-based, a number of French-based, and then there are others. And you find all these little black spots on the map. And if you look at the spots, you see that the northern region, the northern hemisphere, is almost devoid of any example instance of creolization. And the first spots you find are in Africa, somewhere in America, on the coastline of Asia, the southern and eastern coastline of Asia, then in Oceania and others as well in the Indian Ocean. But the northern hemisphere is almost free of examples of creolization. The few examples you find there are pidgin cases that are a little bit controversial still. So, and then there is unfortunate that you don't see Malta here on the map, but there is no black spot for Malta. So this author, John Holm, doesn't consider Maltese an instance of creolization. And I happily join him. So what did I say? So Europe is a Creole-free zone, and there are some only rare birds of creolization in the northern hemisphere. There are some examples. There's some discussion about the Rusinosk variety, that's a pidgin that was seasonally spoken or used by Norwegian and Russian fishermen on the Norwegian-Russian border and on Spitsbergen. But this is extinct because the there was a communication breakdown after the October Revolution in Russia. And then there was some discussion about non-native varieties spoken by migrant workers, for example, in Germany. A migrant workers, German, for example, was considered for about 15 years an instance of creolization or of pidginization, and then it turned out that this is built up on shaky grounds because there is no stable variety. Every individual speaks his or her variety of German, but there is no intersubjective variety that could be called, this is Turkish pidgin German. There was no evidence for that. So we can't really talk about one pidgin or one Creole based on migrant workers' varieties of German. And the same applies to Dutch. There was a large-scale project on Moroccan migrants coming to the Netherlands, and they were suspected to speak a special variety of Dutch, a creolized variety, and then it turned out every Moroccan migrant spoke his or her own variety of Dutch. There were some similarities, but there was no stable form of a pidgin in this case. Now we have to look at linguistics, proper linguistics features. What makes a Creole? Let me just have a drop here. You now know about socio-historical facts, the economical background, and the situation in which, the general situation in which a Creole might develop. But what is the linguistic aspect of a Creole? Are there typical features, properties, grammatical, phonological, lexical features that we associate with a prototypical Creole? And that's probably the most interesting background information for reconsidering the position of Maltese as to creolization. Creolization is not just another term for more or less heavy influence exerted by one language upon another language. The term has a very specific content. First of all, Creoles are new languages, not changed languages. They are neither varieties of the lexifier nor of the languages originally spoken by the slaves. You can't say that this is a West African language with a non-African lexicon, because you can't find the exact predecessor. because there were so many African languages that were involved in the genesis of the Creole language. So there's no single ancestor on that part. Prototypical Creoles share a number of structural features which make them look like representatives of a distinct type of language. Recently, an American scholar has claimed that Creole languages are a separate language type. The grammatically most simple language type you can have. And this is a matter of dispute, and I don't like the argument. I just wanted to tell you that there are some ideas that Creoles, wherever they are spoken on the world map, share essential features to make scholars think that they have detected a new language type. So they are so distinct from other languages that we say, they have something special in common, and so let's make them into a new type, a distinct type. And the pan-Creole features, those features which occur in all of the Creoles, or most of the Creoles, cannot be explained as copies of Indo-European patterns. They have no history in the Indo-European donor languages. That's the most important part. You could also say, it looks like English, but it isn't English. It looks like French, but it isn't French, and so on. And those things I qualified as looking like but not being are the same in all of the Creole languages. That's an important a kind of leitmotif that's going cutting across all of the Creole grammars. Because of that, there are two theories. Never look back, they say. Yeah. There's the substratist theory. The shared features of Creoles are reminiscent of similar properties of many, especially West African languages, and may thus be understood as retentions from the native West African languages of the first slave generation. As I told you before, there were many West African languages, so we can't claim that we have found the original language for every feature we find in a Creole. So maybe some of the features you find in a West African, say Yoruba, a language spoken in Nigeria, and another feature in the same Creole language points to an origin in Liberia, say a Kru language. Another one is Malinke, and so on. And you have combinations of features of languages which are spoken in the same area, very huge area, but which never have been in contact, direct contact with one another, and you can't simply generalize over all the African languages and say that's typically African and that's African and that's African, and then I have detected an African origin, because it's a very peculiar combination of features of several languages. One feature from A, one feature from B, and one feature from C and D, and so on. And that's the reason why the second theory, this diversity of origins, is the reason why the second theory has come about, and that's the universalist theory. Structural similarities occur also in those Creoles for which no historical connection with Africa can be postulated. On the Indian subcontinent, where a lot of Portuguese-based Creoles are spoken. The Portuguese, when they went there, they took some African slaves with them, but then they relied heavily on local slavery. So people from Indonesia were imported to India. Indonesia itself, Macau, that's the city near to Hong Kong on the Chinese coast, and in Oceania. In these cases, the possible substrates, the languages spoken originally by the first slave generation, are different languages which have different structural properties. They are not African languages. And thus, the common features of Creole languages must be explained, now that's the theory, by an innate bioprogram which is activated in catastrophic situations of language learning, where the input is too chaotic to serve as viable language for the child. You remember father and mother of the first slave generation had offspring, and the father and mother in the family spoke probably widely diverging varieties of a learner's varieties of the slaver's language. And they were so diverse structurally, probably, maybe even lexically, that the child had to make, not really a conscious, but had to decide what to make of this chaotic input. This is done subconsciously, and the children in this way create their own new language according to the principles of universal grammar, also called UG, as hardwired in the bio program. How do we explain that all the Creole languages look the same if the input by the parents was so widely divergent? If so chaotic an input can create similar results everywhere on the globe, the results can't depend on the input. They must depend on something else. That was the idea behind this. And if it isn't the input by the parents, it must be something that is already there in the child's head. And that must be something hardwired in the brain, something that is there biologically. Biologically encoded information of how to learn a language if your input is poor, in a way. So this bio program was claimed, or still, let's say, was claimed to be viable also in other situations. In every language learning situation, the bio program is somehow active, and it becomes more active the more unreliable the input is. If you can't make head or tail of the input, just put on your bio program, and then you have a kind of road map for creating a language. You just take the lexicon, that's the only part you take from the input, the lexicon, that's the outer shape maybe of the words, and then fill these words into the slots created by your internal grammar. So there was a very emotionally loaded discussion about this for decades. So this idea dates back to 1984, and I think Derek Bickerton, you probably know the name associated, the creator of this bio program hypothesis. I don't know whether he still advocates the bio program. At least he doesn't do it as vehemently as he did 20 years ago. And there was a lot of discussion, and some ill feeling was also created because there was this kind of, how do you say that, Lager mentality of the substratists and the universalists, and there was nothing in between. Either you were pro-substratum or you were pro-universal grammar. And there was no way out of this dilemma. Nowadays, the situation is a little bit different because people accept that substrates had a role in the creation of the Creoles, which was which Bickerton denied categorically for a long time. Now there is perhaps a situation where you can say, yes, people accept that there was something similar to a bio program, similar, but we don't know exactly what, and that there was the input. Perhaps the input wasn't as chaotic as we thought, and then there are these substrate languages, and we know now from some case studies that some of the substrate languages survived for a relatively long period. So they were there as a second or third code of a family, and not always were the marriages mixed marriages in the linguistically mixed marriages, because in some colonies the slavers had different principles of composing their slave population, because some of the nations in West Africa were renowned for being good workers, so they tried to get as many of these people to work in the colony. And if you have people from the same linguistic group, the basic situation is different. And then you can start to think about, is this still a prototypical situation for the creation of a Creole? And if we look more closely at the cases, are there any prototypical cases at all? For some time, Bickerton even claimed that most of the counterexamples are examples of languages which don't qualify as Creoles, even if it was Haitian or whatever. So now look, let's have a look at one typical pan-Creole feature. Now that it's getting technical in the linguistic sense. Very many Creole languages around the globe make use of so-called pre-verbal TMA parties. These are markers, morphemes, or little words used on the left of a verb to indicate a certain tense, a certain mood, and or a certain aspect. Whereas the verb itself is morphologically invariable. So what do you distinguish on the level of tense? Many prototypical Creole languages distinguish between an anterior tense, that is relative tense, anterior tense and simultaneous tense. There is a special expression if what is described by the verb happened before another event, that's anteriority. If it is simultaneous to another event, there is no special marking. That's like the pluperfect, in a way. It's not a pluperfect, and we can even doubt whether the term tense is correctly applied in this way. It's relative tense, because it's not absolute tense, it's not perfect and not past or whatever. It just says this happened before the other thing. Then there is a distinction between irrealis and realis, things that are real, events that happen and happened and are considered to be real events in life, are left unmarked. But if you are hypothesizing about something, maybe talking about the future, this is still not real, unreal in a way. You are making... you speculate about something, then it's irrealis, a case of irrealis, and these cases are specially marked. You get a word, an expression, a morpheme that marks irreality. Very often it's future tense, but it could be subjunctive, conjunctive, or whatever. You have conditional as well. And then by aspect, progressive, ongoing action, completive, completed action. There are two markers. The one for progressive, the English ing form, for example, is an example of a progressive. But it would be marked in a typical Creole language not by a suffix, as in English. The ing is part of a word, but a particle precedes the verb. And you have another marker for completive. If something is finished, you mark it for a special class of verbs, namely verbs which normally would be called dynamic. There's something going on. They describe an ongoing action. And if you want to focus on the completion of the action, you have to add a marker. Finish would be to finish talking. To talk is a dynamic verb in English. It could go on and on and on, and you have to focus on the terminus of the action. So that's saying, I finished talking. So there are some tables for you to see and short text excerpts in order to make you understand that these features are really widespread among the Creole languages. This is just, I won't bore you with the details. Look at the French-based Creoles here. Creoles from the Antilles, Guyana, Haitian, Louisiana, and the Indian Ocean. Although these languages are spoken in different countries and even in on different continents, they share the feature that they use these pre-verbal particles here in order to encode the distinctions about which I informed you. This is, you have markers for anteriority, for progressive, for completive, for irrealis, for example. There are some details which don't really fit the picture, but we don't talk about these deviations because that's too difficult. We would have to look at a lot more texts, for example. But you find these elements, and if you look at the elements, ka, you can't really see what the hell would ka be in French. If this is a French Creole and all the lexicon stems from French, then perhaps the grammatical morphology or the morphemes, the grammatical words, stem from French as well. This is true for some of the other elements. But what is ka? What element is it in French? And nobody has been able so far to identify the French element. It's probably of a completely different origin. So it can't be etymologized in this kind of Frenchifying way. Some of the other elements are of French origin. This T is été, the participle of the French verb être. Now let's have a look at the English counterpart. For this, the table is even more sizable. Languages spoken on the West African coast, South American coast, in the Caribbean, in North America, and in the Pacific share certain features, namely the use of these pre-verbal particles, some of which are clearly English. There's no problem about that, that the etymology is English, but the use is strange from an English point of view. For example, if you take the progressive marker de, what would de be in English? It is English, but it is the equivalent of the ing form, in a way. But it isn't the ing form because there is no ing there. There is de, that's there. There being used as a pre-verbal marker. And this must clearly be a case of non-English semantics behind it. Because what is there in there that would trigger its use as a marker for progressive tense aspect? So that's one of the instances. You see, there are elements which can outwardly be attributed to English, but the content side can't be taken from English. The reason for the grammaticalization of this element is somewhere else. So many of these languages have these markers. Now have a look at a text where you can see these markers. This is a Haitian text. There is the morphological gloss, and you see this ant there. That hasn't to do with ants. It's the anterior marker. And he said, there was a time when animals had a king who was a very clever and cunning man. He was always telling his advisers, the owner of the body knows the body, meaning the king knows himself. This is just a short passage, and you see there is this te, this up, what else, the te again, the te, the te. The elements there in the sentences look like French, they are reminiscent of French, but the use of these particles is non-French. That makes the text deviate from our expectations of what a French text should look like, even a popular French text, a spoken French, for example. Many of the other elements are clearly French in origin. There's another one which is closer to the lexifier language, that's Jamaican Creole English, is as there. So if you have an etymological gloss for this, this would be the old lady say, wait, what, the what, there go happen. That's clumsy English, at least. That's not really good English. It's no English at all. It is something else. There are English elements of which a non-English use is being made. So English elements used in a non-English way. And I think the day is there again. Where did go happen? What is going to happen? And so on. Many of the other elements are pretty close to English, say colloquial English, but other elements are not. And especially the grammatical markers are not close to English. The lexical ones in this case approach what we know from, say, substandard English. Now, let's have a look at Creole and Maltese. Maltese differs from prototypical Creoles in three important aspects. Of course, socio-historically, Maltese developed over a long period of more or less intensive language contact between a majority group, a linguistically homogeneous majority group, the original speakers of Semitic proto-Maltese, in a way, whose native language was originally Semitic, and a prestigious minority, several prestigious minority groups of migrants who used varieties of Romance. And then there was no need for many migrants because the official language was perhaps Romance in nature, and it had to be used in international communication or in intercommunication with the rulers, for example. There was no, as far as I know, there was no systematic deportation and enforced labor situation on Malta, not to be compared with the plantation situation in the Caribbean Sea, for example. There was no large-scale mixing of socially deprived and linguistically diverse groups. So there were deprived, socially deprived people on Malta at that time. But this was not an agglomeration of representatives of different peoples around the Mediterranean, for example. It was the Maltese and not imported slaves from different places, from a variety of places. So the socially deprived group was linguistically homogeneous. So Romanization, took centuries to reach its present form, and it's still going on, perhaps, in some way. Romanization was achieved via massive borrowing of lexical elements. So there are hundreds of Italian, Sicilian words entered the Maltese lexicon, but they did it step by step, not within one generation. So, and then there are also semantic calques, so Italian patterns translated into Maltese using Semitic vocabulary for that. And restructuring according to Italian, Sicilian patterns, the passive, and so on. There are some examples of that. And then there is continuity versus discontinuity in language history. The Creoles, the prototypical Creoles, are examples of discontinuity because there is the African history is seized at a certain moment, and then the Indo-European history came in. But the Creole is not a kind of continuation of the history of the Indo-European language. Perhaps difficult to understand. I haven't explained myself very well, perhaps. But you see, there is no African language nowadays. There were several African languages before the Creole came into being. Now there are no African languages left. The Creole isn't a representative of African languages. The European languages are still there. And the Creole is not the successor of a language. It hasn't developed continuously from the Indo-European lexifier, but it's somehow maybe split off, in a way, from the Indo-European. It's very difficult to find a model for this, so to modelize the genesis of a Creole language, because it's somehow... not really self-contradictory, but you have to juggle about with these terms. It has developed out of English, the Jamaican Creole, because there is English in it, but it's not all of what English had on offer. And there is African in it, but it's not all the African languages brought with them, and it is several African languages that contributed to the shaping of the Creole. So that's very problematic. You can't really find a continuum between these former stages and the new stages. This is different with Maltese, because Maltese was Maltese before a certain number of Italian words entered Maltese. And it is still Maltese, although a number of English words have entered the language, and so on. It was there, and it changes its shape. Okay, there are additions to it, there are changes, but these are changes that would perhaps have happened under other circumstances as well. So there is no this kind of disruption in the history of Maltese. Now, let's have a look at structural features. There's a typo, but anyway. Some structural features. Let's look at, there is no glottal stop, as you see. It must be a glottal stop in Maltese, the glottal stop. As you see, Maltese has a glottal stop. Atus, if you have this. There's not a single Creole with an Indo-European lexifier with a glottal stop. Even English, you know, substandard varieties of English have the glottal stop and make use of it, but it hasn't made it into Jamaican English, although you know that many substandard speakers were involved when this language developed. But there is no glottal stop. So a glottal stop is a feature that doesn't occur in Creole languages, that doesn't preclude that a language acquires a glottal stop, but it wasn't taken over from the Indo-European lexifier languages. Then Maltese allows for combinations of consonants at the margins of syllables, for example. Not many consonants, but there are. Combinations of two, sometimes you find three. There are certain rules that you have to add an additional vowel to make these more easier, these consonant clustered. But as a general rule, Creole languages don't have consonant clusters, or very, very restricted numbers of consonant clusters. For Maltese, the number is much more impressive than for Creoles. Maltese distinguishes between long and short vowels, and you can distinguish meanings of words by vowel length. There's no Indo-European-based Creole that has this feature, although, for example, Dutch has the feature, and Dutch is the lexifier of the languages, and this has disappeared. Then you also have distinctive consonant lengths in Maltese. You can form the causative, for example, by doubling a consonant, for example. Rikep, rikep. That's the kind, and you then distinguish between two very different meanings in this case. It's grammaticalized in a way. There is no distinctive consonant length in Creole languages. So Maltese has already a number of sometimes rare features, marked features typologically. Not very many languages have these features. There are languages which share these features, but none of these languages is a Creole language. So then there is a very crucial thing. Maltese had what we call bound morphology, that is prefixes, suffixes, infixes, changes of vowels in the phonological chain of words in order to distinguish meanings and grammatical functions. And Maltese is a heavily inflecting language, so that we have a lot of morphology in Maltese. And Creole languages in general lack bound morphology. There are some tiny instances of bound morphology, but these are late developments, mostly late developments. There are some exceptions. You probably heard, was there a talk by Ingo Plaak here? He's one of the specialists, a co-national of mine, a compatriot, who works on the morphology of Creole languages, and he has collected all the instances of Indo-European morphology preserved in Creole languages. There are some instances, but very, very few. So, and there's no system, morphological system, comparable with the Maltese evidence, for example. Maltese is heavy inflecting, and Creole languages normally do not inflect, although their lexifiers like Dutch, Spanish, Portuguese have bound morphologies, for example, in the verb. Now, then Maltese has this, what is commonly called minor number distinctions. You have the dual, darba, darbtein, for two times, and the singulative, collective, klim, kelma, for example. These are distinctions for one single word and a class of words or words as such as a category. These are distinctions regularly, systematically made in Maltese and in a couple of other languages around the globe, but there is no Creole language that has a dual or a singulative collective distinction. So that is something we don't find there. And this is suggestive of the idea that distinctions of this kind don't belong to Creole, to the Creole type, if there is a type. Then, of course, Maltese is a gender language. You have feminine and masculine nouns. You distinguish them. A lot of languages in Europe have this distinction, but not a single Creole language has gender distinctions. And, of course, you have agreement as well. So, then you have subject and object markers on the verbs.
So you mark the subject by prefixes and suffixes according to the aspect of the verb. Niktep und ktipt, for example, there are markers for the subject, and sometimes you have the object clitics you use, ktiptu, in this I wrote it, and so on. These are markers on the verb. The verb carries information about subject and object, and it does so regularly. And this is not reported for any Creole language. Normally, the verbs are not inflected for person, be it subject person or object person. The verb is invariable, an invariable lexical morpheme in this way. So you have aspect-sensitive verb stems. So the vowel qualities change from perfective to imperfective, and the consonants appear in different organizer in different not in different order, but sometimes they are adjacent to another, and sometimes there is a vowel inserted between them. This creates two stems: one for the imperfective present tense or whatever, the other for the perfective, the past tense. This is completely unknown in Creole languages. Then you have these inflected prepositions, alia, alik, and so on. You mark the person on the preposition, completely unknown in Creole languages. You don't have that. And in syntax, organization of sentences, you have agreement, of course. If there is a plural noun, an adjective agrees in number with the noun, and if there is a feminine noun, the adjective agrees in gender with the noun and the masculine as well. This is unknown in Creole languages. Creole languages usually don't have morphological agreement. No wonder there is no gender distinction, but sometimes there is number distinction, singular and plural. But nevertheless, there is no plural marker on adjectives, for example. Then Maltese is a so-called pro-drop language, that is a language that doesn't need a subject pronoun. If you say kitep, that means he wrote. There's no, you don't need the uwa at that. Okay. If you use it, it's somehow emphatic or whatever, but you don't use it. This is like Italian and so on. You know that, and languages of this type are called pro-drop languages, because the idea behind this is that the pronoun is there, but then it is dropped, and it never appears in the spoken version of the sentence. And none of the Creole languages is a pro-drop language. They all need subject pronouns, so they are obligatorily there. And then you have these chains of finite verbs, like kont niktep. I was writing, or I wrote. This is impossible in Creole languages, whereas you have chains of lexical verbs in Creole languages, so-called serial verbs, but you don't have the subject and object markers on the verbs. So there are a number of features which are typical of non-Creole languages, which we find in Maltese, and of course not in a single Creole case. In a way, we could say, let's put it like this, these features we found in Maltese, they would have disappeared if Creolization had taken place. A glottal stop. Not all of the languages of the world have a glottal stop. It's relatively relatively marked features. There are a few languages which have a glottal stop, but not too many. So if we consider this, we say that's a marked feature. Languages don't need a glottal stop to function as a language. So if there is a glottal stop in the input, for example, in Dutch there is a glottal stop. In substandard varieties of English there is a glottal stop. But it doesn't survive creolization because it's too marked a feature. The same as complex consonant clusters. Most of the languages in the world don't allow for combinations of consonants at the syllable margins. The best, modern linguistics lingo, we call it the best structure. The optimal structure is just one consonant on one vowel in combination, and not a combination of several consonants. So we would say if there are complex consonant clusters in the input, these consonant clusters are dissolved into simple consonants because it's a marked structure. It's not so easy to learn, or it's too difficult to learn. That's the idea behind it. There is some discussion about the markedness, the notion of markedness, but that's behind it. All these features we find in Maltese would have been lost under creolization, because they some of these features were there in the European lexifiers but haven't survived into the Creole stage. Let's have a look at a short text. There are three texts to follow. These are translations of Antoine Saint-Exupéry's Le Petit Prince, the first page. There's a Maltese version. One in Papiamento. Papiamento is a Spanish-based Creole spoken on the Netherlands Antilles. That's just off the South American coast. Venezuela is the nearest country. And the French-based Creole spoken on Mauritius, Mauricien. So let's have a look at this and then look at the etymology of the words used in the text. Just determine which is, whether there are several sources for this. Above you see the Maltese version. Let's have a look. Kelisit snin metadarba juktib blissem tasteia. Steia is the first Italian word. The first Italian etymon in the text. Storia steia. So that's the first non-Semitic element. Lia deominum right stampa. Stampa is the second one. Milisbach duar il foresta. Third one. Turiser boa. Perhaps boa is an international term, of course. It would be there anyway, even without Italian. Serb as well? Yeah, okay. Serb. So we have four, five. Copia. Foresta, yes. These are five. Cerv, yes. Cerv. Copia. Disin. Three boa, blah, blah, blah. Prisa. Allura. Mm-hmm. Aventuri. Jungla. Lapis, Irneshili, then Kulur, Tracia is English, to trace, yeah. Disin again, Numru, and that's it. You see that there are quite a few Italian and non-Semitic words, but the majority of the words is of Semitic origin. It is of no avail to count the elements. It's just we have to decide, is the majority of Semitic origin? Yes. The minority, a clear minority, is of non-Semitic origin. Now there are these two Creole examples. If you look at this, Tempo mi tabatin says, Anya ma llega di mira un prenci. Prenci is the first non-Spanish etymon. That's the Dutch word. Prentje is for stampa in this way. Masa bonita de nombuki urwaut is again a Dutch word for jungla in this case. Kuyama historianan capasa prenci again representa colebra boa constrictor animal feroz atacobram prenci de nebuki colebra culino victima hinte drumi lunanan digestion urwaut again promel klurpotlot. That's again lapis talculur in this case. That's a Dutch word, and that's it. There are exactly three Dutch etyma in this. All the rest is Spanish. So there is already a disparity between the Maltese example, lots of Italian words, but the majority from Semitic. And then there is a text, no African word in it, although African languages were involved when the language came into being. 99% is Spanish, and then there is some additional Dutch in it. It's like the English word in the Maltese example, because that's technical terms for modern things, lapis talculur, in this case, for example, prenci, for example. So you can't expect these words to have been there already at the time when the language came into being. These are relatively recent loan words from Dutch. So we could say the Papiamento is practically 100% Spanish, whereas this is not true for Maltese as to Italian and Semitic. And this is the French text, and as far as I know, there is not a single element there that couldn't be attributed to French. We don't have to look at this exactly. So this is 100% French, this is 90-something percent Spanish, and this is overwhelmingly Semitic with some Italian additions. So you see, a Creole language receives its vocabulary, the lexicon, from one major source. All of the lexicon. And there's nothing left of the African past in the lexicon. Not the shape of the words. The words, the shape they come in, is the European shape, the changed shape, European change, shape. The meaning of the words is sometimes deviant from a European perspective, whereas in Maltese, you can find continuity because the Semitic element was the element that was there before contact was made with Romance languages, for example. So the Semitic element there represents the continuity in the history of Maltese, whereas you can't find a continuity in these two other languages because the African part has disappeared. There is just Spanish, but this isn't Spanish. That's not a variety of Spanish. There is French, but this isn't French. There is Semitic, and this is Semitic in Maltese. So what the texts reveal is that Maltese version contains a minority of Romance items. The vast majority of words has a Semitic origin. The Papiamento text contains exclusively, that's not true, there are four Dutch words as well, words with a Spanish etymology, and the translation into Mauritian is in its entirety works on the basis of a French-derived vocabulary. Thus, the Italian Romance element in Maltese is an admixture, no matter how strong it is. But the impact of the donor language is by far less important in the case of Maltese than in the two Creole cases, because all of the vocabulary comes from the donor language. As these days, texts, these display texts where the Indo-European lexicon is without competitor. There is no African competitor to the Indo-European vocabulary there. And in Maltese, there is an Indo-European part share of the lexicon, but there is a Semitic competitor to this, and a strong competitor. And final page. Yeah, the conclusions now. I already have kept you for too long, perhaps. So, here are the conclusions. Maltese is not a Creole. It instantiates a case of massive long-term borrowing relations between Maltese as recipient language and Italo-Romance as a donor language. Several varieties of Italo-Romance. The history of Maltese follows a pattern completely different from the one postulated for prototypical Creoles. There is no evidence for a pidgin phase. To have a pidgin phase there we would have, we would need the demographical situation typical of a European slave colony, for example. Structurally, Maltese does not share the typical pan-Creole features. We have seen that in phonology, morphology, and syntax, there are structural differences. And again, structurally, Maltese has a lot of properties which are unknown in prototypical Creole cases. The Maltese lexicon is mixed. The Creole lexicon is not necessarily mixed to a higher degree than usual. And then it's recent mixture. And Maltese is a representative of intensive contact-induced reshaping similar to the cases of, now I tell you about these, Zamorro and Tetumdili. Zamorro is an Austronesian language spoken on the Mariana Islands in the Western Pacific that was heavily influenced by Spanish. 60% of the vocabulary stem from Spanish. The rest is Austronesian. The grammar is still Austronesian, although you can find texts where hardly any Austronesian word is used. Everything is Spanish. You can find the other way around as well. There are texts without any Spanish word. It depends on the text genre, for example. But there the vocabulary is 60% Spanish. That's perhaps roughly the same for the Italian component in Maltese. But that hasn't changed the typological character of Chamorro. It's still an Austronesian language. And the Spanish rule over the islands lasted for 250 years, so that was long enough a period to change a language. And Tetumdili is another example. There the Portuguese element is at least as strong as the Spanish one in Chamorro. Tetumdili is another Austronesian language spoken in East Timor, which was a Portuguese colony for more than 400 years. And there is no Portuguese left there, but in Tetumdili, in this language. So Portuguese is responsible for, again, 60% of the vocabulary of the language, but the typological character, the structure of the language, has remained Indonesian-Austronesian. So it hasn't become an Indo-European language. It is like the Maltese case. Maltese hasn't become a Romance language, although one would like to say it's at least some kind of mixture, but it hasn't become. It hasn't changed a genetic affiliation from Semitic to Romance. There is a strong Romance component, but as long as the basic Semitic component is there, there are no grounds to assume that the language has changed genetically. And the same is true of Chamorro and Tetum Dili, and this shows that Maltese is not an isolated case in the phenomenology of contact linguistics, and it's not a unique case. Thank you very much.
Ringrazio ħafna lil professor Stolz. Jekkaw xi ħadd li jista' jagħmel xi mistoqsija.
Very stimulating, Thomas. Well done. I'm rather intrigued by the fact of the Creoles in Europe. How about Yiddish and the lingua franca?
Yeah, these are two cases. Yiddish is clearly a case of a Germanic language with a large component of Slavic admixture and some retention from Hebrew. So because this is in a way has a certain social history, Yiddish is sometimes considered a special case in contact linguistics, but it has directly developed out of a relatively normal variety of medieval German. So it's a kind of middle-high German with some regional features you can pinpoint. That's Bavarian, some Rhenish elements, Lothringian elements, and then people migrated, had to migrate. They were forced out of the German Empire and had to migrate eastwards. And eastwards, in that's Poland and later Ukraine and so on, they acquired additional features there. And so these are recent loans from other languages, and there was perhaps in the long history of Yiddish, never a period where there was pidginization took place and creolization, because the language has still retained in inflectional morphology, although it is not like standard German, for example, and perhaps even a little bit deviant from Middle High German.
It can be called a variety.
Yeah, but there is bound morphology, and you just like Maltese, you would find features in Yiddish which don't fit the Creole prototype. And then there is the other point, the history, the speakers who adopted this German were perhaps, we don't know that, perhaps linguistically homogeneous, because this was a certain group that immigrated to the territory, perhaps already in the Roman period. We don't know that exactly, because there are competing theories about this. One hypothesis is that it was an immigration from the east to Germany and then back. But the group itself came there as a linguistically homogeneous group. So there were the conditions were different from the cases of the slave colonies, because there were speakers in the slave colonies of various languages. And there was one, we don't know which one, most probably not Hebrew, but one other variety brought in from Eastern Europe, perhaps from Southeast Europe. And the other was lingua franca. Yeah, lingua franca, that's perhaps not a real pidgin and not a real Creole, because as far as we know, lingua franca was just used for certain purposes. So it was a kind of, maybe more of a jargon.
It was a language of decimal.
And it never developed, as far as we know, native speakers, so we can't say anything about the creolization, but it was in use in the ports in the Mediterranean, and perhaps its structure varied from port to port, from situation to situation, from contact constellation to contact.
There were two types, the Spanish-based and the Italian-based.
Yeah, if there are two types, mm-hmm.
But I was referring mostly to the fact that the grammar of the lingua franca is unsystematic. Mm-hmm. Can we say that the grammar of Creole languages is unsystematic?
No.
Or does it form a system?
Mm-mm-mm. The grammar of Creoles is systematic, it's stable. The grammar of pigeons, that's a different case, because normally people distinguish between an unstable kind of pigeon. This is the situation I described for families with a various background in African languages and then speaking various varieties without a fixed form. And if this kind of pigeon goes on to exist for a longer period, then it can develop into a stable pigeon without acquiring native speakers. Sometimes the widespread English-based pigeon spoken in Papua New Guinea is taken as a kind of showcase, Tokpisin. Nowadays, people claim that there are native speakers, but perhaps there aren't too many native speakers, and for a very long period, it was just a non-native language of many people. But it had it has a relatively stable grammar. It's systematic. But then there was perhaps a phase before that, a proto-pigeon phase, where it was incredibly unstable. And that is what is reported for a variety of pigeon situations. Believe it or not, I have a hearing problem. That's why I have to approach you. You too?
Yeah. Well, my doctor is about slavery in Malta. Mm-hmm. That was a night. I could say, you know, one or two important conclusions relevant to what we've been doing listening this evening. Mm-hmm. For example, slavery in Malta had nothing to do with slavery across the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. Absolutely different. Yeah. Here, it was more like prisoners of war than anything else. Then, with regards to the demographic side of it, which is so important, we never had more than a smallish, that is, what could it have been? 2,000 or 3,000 out of a population of 50,000.
Okay, it's what a minority.
That would be a very relatively small minority, while you're talking of a very great majority.
10 to 1, to sometimes 100 to 1.
Half of those slaves were Arabic speakers, mm-hmm. very close to Maltese,
yes.
Tripolitanians, Tunisians, and so on.
Yeah.
The other half were Turkish. Mm-hmm. Or Turkish speakers, yeah. one way or another. And then a sprinkling of others, but small numbers. Okay? So what we've been saying about, what you've been telling us about slavery, does not apply to Malta at all. Yeah. It kept us perhaps in contact with the wider lexicon of the Arabic world, which might explain certain words which you could find perhaps in Aden only, mm-hmm. things like that, you know? But otherwise, I wouldn't think it to be relevant very much. Slavery over here. We had also black slaves, mm-hmm. but the proportion there was even smaller.
And they came from
came from the Arab world mainly.
Mm-hmm. So they were already Arabic speakers.
The Arab ships trade and mm-hmm. On the transportation of slaves across the Mediterranean, and we had our ships, mm-hmm. sort of. And that's all we know about it. But they came from across the Sahara.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps
a totally different route.
Yeah, I see the situation was completely different. So
completely.
You can't really compare these two cases.
It can only explain the survival of certain words in Maltese.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Campus FM għadu kem waslilkom l-ewwel taħdita minn serje ta' taħdidiet organizzati mid-Dipartiment tal-Malti fl-Università fl-imkien mal-Kunsill Nazzjonali tal-Ilsim Malti.